Welcome to Film Roast.
Hey everyone, Hannah here, the co-host of Film Roast, where two overcaffeinated and underqualified friends talk about all things movies. If you like film factoids, lots of sarcasm, and bad impressions, check us out on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Film Roast Show and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmroast. Happy roasting!
Hi, everybody.
Hello, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
And I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm talking to you about Phyllis Schlafly.
I don't think I'm ready.
Yeah, no one is.
Because once, it was that funny thing where once you hear about something, then you start to hear it everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I started to hear more about her everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And I think I'm going to vomit. So yeah, if you have a bucket handy.
Literally the worst.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Because I might use it. And I'm going to be talking to you before we get to her about the lovely Empress Leopoldina of Brazil, who's almost like the exact opposite of Phyllis Schlafly.
Okay. All right. Good. So we'll have a nice dichotomy.
You'll see what I mean at the end. So she was born January 22nd, 1797 in Schönbrunn Palace in Vienna.
Okay.
Ooh, tongue twister. Her birth name was Caroline Josepha Leopoldine Franziska Ferdinanda.
Okay.
Also tongue twister. But we'll just call her Empress Leopoldina.
Mm-hmm.
Her parents were Holy Roman Emperor Francis II and his second wife, Maria Theresa of the Two Sicilies.
Now that's a title.
Mm-hmm. Holy Roman Emperor.
Mm-hmm.
Who's your dad? Oh, it's just the Holy Roman Emperor. It's casual.
Just His Royal Highness.
So she's commonly known as Maria Leopoldina, but she didn't start going by that name until she became an archduchess and traveled to Brazil. She's named as Maria Leopoldina in all documents after that. And so we'll kind of get to that later on.
Okay.
But there's some speculation that she may have started using the name Maria due to her devotion to the Virgin Mary.
Okay.
She was one of 12 children, and among her siblings, one would become Emperor Ferdinand I of Austria.
All right.
And one was Marie Louise, Duchess of Parma, and wife of Napoleon Bonaparte.
Oh, my word.
So.
So small family.
Small family.
Not all influential.
Yeah. Not a, you know, high society family here at all.
Sure.
Very low-key.
Father's His Holy Roman Emperor, brother-in-law's Napoleon.
So her grandfather was Emperor Leopold II, and she was taught the educational principles that he laid down.
Okay.
So she would practice her handwriting by copying the following text.
Okay.
This is great. Quote, "Do not oppress the poor. Be charitable. Do not complain about what your God has given you, but improve your habits. We must strive earnestly to be good."
Oh my God.
End quote. Do you see what I mean about literally being literally being the total opposite? So she learned French and Latin. She was educated in drawing, piano, writing, hunting. Her mother died when she was 10 years old, and her father remarried Maria Ludovica of Austria. She was a singer. Maria's passions were natural sciences, especially botany and mineralogy, and she was apparently guided by the three Habsburg principles: discipline, piety, and a sense of duty.
Okay.
Now, Habsburg, of course, refers to House of Austria, and she also scorned physical beauty as a useless vanity.
Oh my.
We should post a picture of her, though, because she's one of those people who's like, "I don't care about if I'm beautiful," and you're like, "You're the most gorgeous woman in the world." So, like, of course you don't. Why don't you be quiet?
God bless.
Yeah. Blessings for you. On September 24th, 1816, Maria's father announced that Pedro of Braganza, a prince of Portugal who would later become the first ruler of Brazil, wanted to marry an Austrian princess.
Okay.
And it was suggested that Maria was chosen because it was her turn to get married in the line of 12. So, like, that's who was available.
Sure.
This would, of course, be an advantageous marriage for the House of Braganza, since Napoleon had conquered Portugal and Maria's sister was wife to Napoleon, so it all fit together nicely.
Sure.
So in April 1817, two ships full of scientists, painters, gardeners, and a taxidermist, all with assistants, were sent to Rio de Janeiro, where Pedro lived, to study the history and geography of Brazil and also to learn Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
During these weeks, Maria created a handbook for herself, Evad Mecum, which means go with me, filled with any information that she knew about Brazil. And it was a unique document that had never been produced by an Austrian princess before.
Okay.
Now, on May 13th, 1817, Maria was married to Dom Pedro by proxy. So he wasn't there. And his place was Maria's uncle, Archduke Charles. Basically, it's like, you're not him, but you're going to pretend to be him.
Does the guy you're standing in for take this lady to be your...
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Sadly, he couldn't be here tonight, but we right. accept this award on his behalf. Sure. I think it's kind of that situation.
Right.
So she was married in May, but she left Austria in August in 1817. And after an 81-day voyage, she finally arrived in Rio de Janeiro and met her husband for the first time. And Maria was expecting, based on the reports that she got back, that Pedro was going to be a perfect, well-educated gentleman. But the reality of his personality and character were very, very different. He had an impulsive temperament. He could get quite angry. He was modestly educated. He wasn't the smartest. Mm. And the two immediately also struggled with communication. He spoke very little French. And even though Maria had learned Portuguese for him,
right.
his grasp of Portuguese was vulgar.
Oh, no. What did he speak? Just like vulgar Portuguese?
I guess.
Ew.
And then he's only 18 years old and he was already a ladies' man. The same year that he was married to Maria, he was living with a French dancer and his father had to come and remove her from the court a month after Maria's arrival.
God.
Now, the couple lived in the Palace of São Cristóvão, occupying 6 rooms, and it was obviously a much different climate from Austria or really mm-hmm. anywhere in Europe because it's South America,
right.
totally different continent.
Sure.
The courtyard and stables were unpaved. The frequent tropical rainfall would just turn them into mud and grossness. There were insects everywhere, and any clothing made of velvet rotted and turned moldy because it was so hot and
yeah.
humid.
Uh-huh.
So in 1821, the court returned to Portugal in a fleet of 11 ships, and the entire royal family of Portugal was forced to flee years before due to Napoleon conquering, but Prince Pedro was the only one who remained behind in Brazil, kind of as regent of the country. So you okay. have the rest of the family being like, it's cool for us to go back, and Pedro being like, nah. So there's high tension between the Portuguese and the Brazilians. Pedro was not an effective ruler, and he's left behind with no one to back him up. He squabbled with his own Portuguese troops. Like, nobody was listening to him.
Weird.
And Maria made clear in her correspondence, because mm-hmm. she wasn't there at the time, that she was very sympathetic to the Brazilian people who are being sort of subjugated under the Portuguese rule.
Right.
And even expressed a desire that the country achieve independence.
Oh.
And because of her attitude, she was venerated by the Brazilian people. Now, here's the thing. There's like a lot going on in Brazil at the time. Mm-hmm. And kind of like I was saying in last week's episode, we're sort of tuning into Lost at season 3.
Right.
And so basically what it boils down to, you know, this what you missed on last season is that Brazil is a huge country. Mm-hmm. It's obviously very hard for someone to rule over the whole thing equally because it's so ginormous. There's no internet. There's no TV. Like, it's 1821. There's probably not significant or sufficient telegraph wiring or a postal service or anything. So,
right.
like, it's not really anyone's fault. It's
right,
a
right,
giant
right.
piece of land that you just can't be like, we're in charge.
Right. There's no mechanism right. to effectively get
exactly.
everyone under
so
control.
So the people of Brazil wanted Pedro to stay in Brazil to rule because him being there meant that Brazil was recognized as a kingdom united to Portugal instead of just as a colony.
Right.
But Pedro was being called back to Portugal and there were fears that if he left, a civil war might break out, probably between the people that wanted him to stay and the people that wanted him to go. The important thing is that in August of 1822... Pedro gives official power to Maria,
okay.
appointing her to head of the Council of State and acting princess regent of the Kingdom of Brazil. She had legal powers to govern the country in his absence, and he left, and hopefully her being there was going to prevent a war from breaking out.
Right.
Which is like, just think about this conversation for a minute.
Right.
Hi, honey. The office is sending me away for, you know, 6 months, probably minimum, given that's an 81-day voyage there and
right.
back. Can you just, you know, keep the country cool while I'm gone and, like, don't let a civil war break out?
I'm going to run away because everyone's getting really mad.
So,
and I'm going to leave you in charge.
Yeah. So, like, peace. What? It's so crazy.
Thanks for the help, honey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. basically, Maria received the news that Portugal was prepping an action against Brazil, probably some sort of military action. And she didn't have time to wait for Pedro to get back and consult with him. Right. So she's like, what do I do? So she gets advised by José Bonifácio de Andrada e Silva, one of Pedro's advisors. Mm-hmm. And on September 2nd, she met with the Council of State and signed a decree of independence declaring that Brazil was not a separate entity from Portugal. So not declaring independence, saying we're all on the same team, but
we're just going to be our own thing.
We're going to do our thing, but with them. So she sends a letter to Pedro, along with a letter from José explaining the whole situation. She's included comments from Portugal that was criticizing the way Pedro was ruling Brazil, as well as his father, King Joa. And in her letter, she demanded that he officially proclaim the independence of Brazil mm-hmm. and warns that the pommel is ripe. Pick it up already or it will rot.
So
basically, like, I've signed this thing,
right?
But it's not going to last for long.
Right.
So do something. So he officially declares the country's independence on September 7th, 1822. Now, here's where it gets really cool. Immediately after, Maria got to work designing the Brazilian flag, the color scheme of which is still part of the flag today, green and yellow. And she mm-hmm. chose these colors to illustrate the marriage between the houses, Pedro's house, Braganza, and Habsburg, her house.
Oh.
Who knew?
Yeah.
So Pedro's father, the king, died on March 10th, 1826, and uh-huh. Pedro inherited the Portuguese throne and became King Pedro, while also remaining Emperor Pedro of Brazil.
Sure.
So Maria thus becomes both Empress Consort of Brazil and Queen Consort of Portugal. So she's ruling over two countries.
Right.
2 months later, Pedro was forced to give up the Portuguese throne to their 7-year-old daughter, Maria.
Oh, no.
Who
forced him?
This is like another story, right?
Sounds like a lady bet.
Right. So at the end of November, Pedro was scheduled to travel now to Uruguay to join his soldiers. And there was a huge farewell party thrown for him. And he demanded that both his wife, Maria, and his mistress appear together and receive his kiss on the hand. Now, this, of course, would be a huge...
Right. Scandal.
Scandal. Right. In front of, especially, there's all these diplomatic dignitaries. And so Maria would have to officially have recognized this mistress if she showed up. So she refused to appear.
Oh, good.
They had a bitter argument and he departed Uruguay without finding a resolution. Now, shortly after Pedro left, Maria became ill with a fever and suffered a miscarriage. She died 8 days later, December 11th, 1826, just 5 weeks before her 30th birthday. She's ruling over like half the world and going, yeah, Brazil should be its own country. I'm going to design them a flag real quick. Hubby, mm-hmm. just sign this decree.
She's not
even 30 years old. She and Pedro, they did have 7 children, so they obviously worked something out in the bedroom situation. Her 4 oldest children were daughters, and that was another thing. She kept having daughters, and people were pissed about it.
Right.
So finally, when she had a son,
it's her fault.
Right. And then her youngest boy would later become Pedro II, Emperor of Brazil. It's thought now that our popularity amongst the native Brazilians was actually able to lift the popularity of our husband and the monarchy as a whole because she was considered very charitable mm-hmm. and intelligent. And I like I love the handwriting mm-hmm. thing that she had to practice. And I think that probably really informed her decision of saying, these are the Brazilian people and we Portuguese people don't need to be ruling them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's get out.
Yeah, be happy with what you have.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she's pretty cool.
How very cool. And just thinking that she signed that declaration saying like Brazil's going to be its own thing. Still under Portugal, but Brazil's going to be its own thing like sometime in her mid-20s.
Yeah. And then also like, but can you just make them your own thing? We're not having a son.
Right.
Like that's probably your bargaining chip.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for sharing.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So let's move on to...
Oh, no.
Villa Schlafly.
Here's the thing, though. Here's what I'll say to start. Number one, we've always said on our podcast, we have to cover both good women and bad women.
Yes.
And we've covered some serious badasses.
Yeah.
You know, Belle Gunness being one of them most recently. And I think it's important to remember that women are not one whole group.
Yes.
You can't lump them all in together.
Exactly.
Sort of how all people with very dark skin or black skin are not necessarily African American.
Correct.
They could come from somewhere else.
Right.
Or they might not be American. Like,
right, exactly.
You know, I went to school, or when I was in community college, one of our fellow students was from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So he was not African American. He was just African.
Just African.
And so it's important to remember that there, we can't just say all women are going to be the same and behave
agreed,
the same.
Agreed. And one of the reasons why I think it's so important to share Phyllis's story in particular, yeah, is because what we are going through now, mm-hmm, is directly related to her. And in, yeah, fact, it is mostly because of her.
Right.
And I think if you're going to effectively fight something, if you're going to effectively protest and organize and vote and run for office against a particular political platform,
yeah,
then you need to know where it came from, how, yep, it came to be, the evolution of it, and who made it that way.
Yeah.
So that you can know who you're fighting.
Absolutely.
So Phyllis was born August 15th, 1924, and she was born Phyllis McAlpin Stewart in St. Louis. She grew up in the Depression, and her father actually faced pretty long-term unemployment, which forced her mother to enter into the labor market.
Mm.
Her mom not only supported the family, but she also supported Phyllis going to a Catholic school.
Mm.
Phyllis ends up going to college early, works as a model for a little bit, but ends up graduating 1944 Phi Beta Kappa with a Bachelor of Arts from Washington University in St. Louis before moving on to Radcliffe College in 1945, where she received her Master of Arts, which, funnily enough, Radcliffe is the same school that Hillary Clinton went to. So they both went.
I was going to say, I have friends that live and work and attend WashU, so, you know, it's fine.
Yeah. In a later book, we find out that during World War II, which is during this time, because she graduates right in 1945, mm-hmm, she worked as a ballistics gunner and technician at the largest ammunition plant in the world.
Whoa.
She tried to go on to earn her Juris Doctorate degree from Washington University, but financial situations forced her into other things.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing about Phyllis, and what I'm really going to talk about today, is her work defeating the ERA. Just, mm-hmm, like Gloria Steinem, although in a much different political direction,
right,
if we were to do an episode just on Phyllis Schlafly, we could probably fill about 3 episodes just talking about,
wow,
her, the political things that she did. I mean, there you can find comments from Phyllis on just about every single political moment, starting from the 1960s and 70s and 50s, all the way up till when she died in 2016. One of her last political acts was to endorse Donald Trump for the presidency. Mm-hmm. So she came to national attention for the, mm-hmm, really first time when she sells millions of copies of her very first book. It's called A Choice, Not an Echo, which was actually distributed as part of Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential campaign, especially in California, because the Republican primary was very contentious at the time. What's important about A Choice, Not an Echo, is it's where she comes up with one of her most potent political attacks that she uses for basically the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. And what it is she talks about what she calls, quote, secret kingmakers, who are the ones who are actually deciding elections. Instead of elections being a public thing,
right,
she's feeding off the populism of people thinking, oh, well, you know, our elections are decided beforehand by people in Washington.
That's her idea?
That was hers. Yeah, she came up with that.
So she's like the original conspiracy theorist?
She's one of them. Yeah, Phyllis, her legacy for us, and I'll talk a little bit about this a little bit later as well, is a lot of the talking points that we have to this day, a lot of the arguments that, yeah, we hear in our everyday politics today come directly from her. Today, we'd probably call these, quote, secret kingmakers the deep state, which is,
right,
a comment we hear all of the time. Barry Goldwater, I should also note, is the failed presidential campaign who created the Southern Strategy, which is how Nixon won his, mm-hmm, presidential campaign, which is the first time where they used the fear of the civil rights movement to get people out in the South to vote basically against the civil rights movement.
So just
movement.
Replace civil rights with,
exactly, let's
Muslims,
just get
terrorism,
rid of the,
what are, whatever, I don't know what that movement
pick
would
your
called.
Minority, pick your,
yeah,
minority.
Pick your minority.
In 1967, she loses a bid for the presidency of the National Federation of Republican Women against actually a more moderate candidate. And then in 1970, she runs again for the House of Representatives out of a seat in Illinois again, but she loses again to a man named George E. Shipley. Now, here's where we get to the big moment, okay, right? So all of this is the little things that are coming beforehand. And now comes 1977, the National Women's Conference in Houston. Right. Remember, we talked about this last with Gloria Steinem, where we talk about Coretta Scott King and all these other Shirley Chisholm and Patsy Takamoto Mink and all these other amazing people being at this one conference. Phyllis had created an alternate conference called a counter conference called the Pro-Life Pro-Family Rally, which made it clear, or they were trying to make it clear, that the feminists did not speak for them. And at their rally, they announced the beginning of a, quote, pro-family movement to fight against politicians who had been supporting feminism and liberalism and to promote, quote, family values in American politics. And so basically, it's at this moment where we start to see the rightward march of the Republican Party. Because when the ERA is first introduced, it gets majority of the Congress, 90% of both houses of Congress passed it, 35 states passed it, passed the ratification. And Phyllis is responsible not only for stopping the last three from ratifying, you need 38 states to ratify an amendment to the Constitution. She also gets, just like we talked about in the Gloria Steinem episode, she gets three to rescind, one of which passes a law saying if the ERA does not get fully ratified by the deadline, that ours no longer counts.
Right.
And we won't recognize any other state. And then she also gets Kentucky to veto the measure to put it in, right? But then, of course, there's that whole congressional thing, constitutional thing. Can a governor veto an amendment to the Constitution from the legislature? Right. Blah, blah, blah. The main argument against the ERA, and the organization that she started was called Stop ERA. STOP itself was an acronym standing for Stop Taking Our Privileges. She argued that the ERA would take away gender-specific privileges currently enjoyed by women, including, quote, dependent wife benefits under Social Security, separate restrooms for males and females.
Oh, Lord.
An exemption from the Selective Service, aka women would be drafted.
I want to make a statement, and that statement is the only privileges I have ever enjoyed as a woman is sometimes if I don't have correct change and I don't have any other money with me and I smile, people let me walk out and I owe 47 cents. That is the only privilege I've ever gotten.
She has this quote where she said, and this is a paraphrase, she essentially says, because women can give birth, because we can create life and give birth, and there's nothing we can do about that, then it is men's responsibility and his sole responsibility to provide for the wife. And so if you pass the ERA, you're going to have an overturn of the structure of society where it is man's responsibility to provide for his wife and his children. And so it's like this weird argument where she's not arguing that the ERA wouldn't give women rights. She's arguing that the ERA would strip men of their responsibilities to take care of their families. And so she would lose, women as a whole would lose the privileges of being, you know, a dependent wife and being a dependent person.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, the thing is, I'm really trying to listen to this because I didn't do research on my own because, you know, we like to learn in the moment.
Right.
And like, I was really trying, and I am still trying to have an open mind as you read me all these things, because I am very pro-choice, because my opinion is, you know, unless it's my body, it's not my choice, and I don't have an opinion. Right. I would support, you know, a friend of mine or whoever, either way, whichever way that they wanted to go in that specific area, and really in any area, you know?
Yeah.
I have friends that got married at 18. I have friends that are still single. Like, you do you. Absolutely. Is very much my opinion. But this argument is, it just doesn't seem very logical.
Well, it goes against the way that laws are supposed to be passed in this country. They're supposed to be passed devoid of, you know, religious sense or devoid of your personal beliefs. And so for me, you know, if you were to ask me, would I get an abortion? You know, like, if I were a woman, first of all, and could have the ability, right? Let's assume that that's the thing.
Right.
You know, I don't know what choice I would make. And I don't think that it's possible to know how you're going to decide in that situation. Right. You know what I mean? But the way I feel about abortion does not change the fact that I believe that everyone should have the ability to have their own beliefs on abortion, to make their own choices on abortion.
Right.
Exactly.
But anyway, my point being, yeah, it's just not a logical argument because I just don't understand. Like, unfortunately, I kind of understand the pro-life argument. I can get it. I might not agree with it, but I'm like, I get where you're coming from.
Exactly.
I see you.
And I think that comes from us living in the South and knowing and living and loving those people.
But I just, like, I don't understand. Again, it's like, if women have the choice, some make the choice and still make the choice to be a stay-at-home mom.
Yeah.
Or to remain single or to get married and to not have kids.
Right.
Maybe the world was very different when this was being voted on, but I'm just like, I don't really, whatever.
Well, see, the thing is that it wasn't. So here's some of the things that she did in order to engender, because at first, before Phyllis gets involved, everyone was about it. When I say that literally 90% of both houses of Congress, that's Republicans and Democrats, voted for the passage, President Nixon was in favor of the law, of the amendment. 35 states, their legislatures, had already passed it right before they get it. So they start doing a couple things. Phyllis, along with the other anti-ERA activists, used the traditional symbols of the American housewife, the fresh-baked pie, and homemade jams, and they would walk all of these things, loaves of bread, to the congressional offices.
That's
saying
bribery.
Things like, preserve us from a congressional jam, vote against the ERA sham, and I am for mom and apple pie, right? So they're doing all these things like, vote against,
how is
I don't
that
want
even
this,
legal?
I don't want. There's probably, I think in the federal government, there's a lot, there's like a level of what,
say,
like a price.
I was going to say an apple pie is like less than $5.
Right, that's, I think, what it is. Yeah.
I'm so angry.
What they also did. Okay. So here's a concrete example of what they did as well. In the 1970s, the feminist movement, so now and some other groups, got together to create a movement that started a program to help older divorced and widowed women, many of whom were ineligible for Social Security benefits, who were not receiving alimony for whatever reason, and because of their long lives as housewives, had few skills on which to enter the labor force afterwards. So they started this program trying to help them back into the workforce. And there was kind of like an inter-party fight between the feminists and the ERA people, criticizing the program for helping older and divorced widowed women as opposed to helping minority women or people in lower income households. Or the criticism got to such a point where the National Organization for Women now, by 1980, downplays the program because they're trying to focus on ratification of the ERA. So Phyllis swoops in and uses the inter-party fight to say, you're abandoning older middle-class widows and divorcees in need because you're no longer supporting this program because, and then said, and you know what? If the ERA is passed, that's just going to continue on happening. You're going to keep ignoring older women and divorced women. Basically, because of all this, we have Phyllis Schlafly to thank for the death of the Equal Rights Amendment. Even in 2007, when they tried to pass the renewed Equal Rights Amendment, she came back. Only this time, it was including the homosexual movement, the queer movement, to say, oh, if you pass the ERA, now we're going to be given even more rights to gay people and even more rights to women and even more rights to this. And it's just going to degrade the family
value. And all the bathrooms are going to go away.
This. Exactly. I mean, literally, that was the argument. I mean, where we see the whole bathroom bill in North Carolina, that argument comes directly from Phyllis Schlafly.
And you know what my argument is? I use the men's bathroom all the time. There's usually not a line. And if it's a oneer, I don't want to have to wait to pee. I just go for it.
Exactly.
You don't have
to.
You do
what you have
to. Nope. Yeah, you do you.
You do what you have to. So that's basically it. I mean, that's Phyllis Schlafly. There's a couple lady bits that I think I want to do on her as well, just to focus on a couple other things. Again, we could talk for ages about her impact on our society. In fact, a political scientist, his name is Alan Wolf, wrote in The New Republic in 2005, quote, if political influence consists in transforming this huge and cantankerous country in one's preferred direction, Schlafly has to be regarded as one of the two or three most important Americans of the last half of the 20th century. Although he also added, every idea she has ever had was scatterbrained, dangerous, and hateful. So that's Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, that's really all I have time to say about her, and that's all the time I want to devote to her. She did have six kids, one of whom came out as gay, although she said in interviews that he supported all of her views as well. She passed away September 5th, 2016, of cancer, shortly after endorsing Trump for the presidency. So here's my final thought on Phyllis Schlafly.
Yeah. I think what I would say as my final thought is her story shows how fear and an unwillingness to listen, understand, or compromise with your fellow patriots of the United States, all citizens who live here, is much more dangerous than someone who simply holds a different political view.
Mm-hmm.
While I may not agree with a lot of more conservative views on the economy or how you should handle welfare or how you should handle healthcare or any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, I do think, and the more that I have listened to politicians, actually surprisingly more in the last year,
mm-hmm.
everyone is really trying to do what they think is best for their belief system.
Yeah.
And it's when you have someone whose belief system is just sort of founded on untruths and on fear.
Being contrarian.
And,
yeah.
And paranoia, mm-hmm. then that's what's dangerous.
Absolutely.
And that's what we have to be wary of when mm-hmm. we are voting or participating in the politics in this
exactly.
country. Hi friends, it's Allison here. Well, I'm not here. I'm actually in New Mexico filming my movie, Banging Lainey. And that movie is what gave birth to this podcast years ago. Max and I chatting about it, and I'm so, so excited that he has helped me so far. And you listeners have helped so much in making this movie happen. And that means two episodes this month. There's going to be some special guests with Max. And if you are enjoying this podcast, if you want to help more awesome movies happen made by women, supporting learning about women, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. You get access to the contributors blog. I'll probably throw up some behind the scenes photo from our film there as well. Check it out. $1 a podcast, $2 a podcast, $10 a podcast. Can do it all at patreon.com/UrsulaMajor. If you're not able to donate financially, I totally understand. I'm working for free for a month in New Mexico. But what you can do is just look down at your phone, your computer, your tablet, your Google Glass, whatever you're listening to this podcast on, and leave us a rating or a review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast. I can't wait to come back and talk to you all in March. Thank you. Well, to brighten things up now, we have another segment of The Bitch Next Door.
The Bitch Next Door.
It's one of my new favorite segments.
Absolutely. So great.
So I'm so excited for you to listen to our guest today.
Yes.
Hey, I'm Julie Harris Walker. I have a podcast called The Other 50%, A History of Hollywood. And on that podcast, I talk to women who work in the entertainment industry to really hear their stories and how did they get where they are and what is it really like? Because, you know, there is so much chatter right now in the world about women in workplaces and in Hollywood especially. And I really wanted to talk to women who are doing it. Like, what's the actual experience? What's going on? But who I am, I didn't start, you know, I wasn't born doing a podcast. I was an acting major back in the day at NYU. And then I immediately got out of acting as fast as I could. And mm-hmm. I went straight into accounting and production finance, because that's a straight path, as every actor will tell you. So I produced commercials. I audited movies and TV for the Walt Disney Company. And I did production finance for HBO and the Weinstein Company. And then I spent the last it will be 10 years being vice president of marketing and sales for Entertainment Partners,
who's
the payroll and software company for production.
Nice. And is that what you're still doing now?
No. Well, technically, I'm a consultant with Entertainment Partners for a few more months. But about a year and a half ago, I kind of separated from that job so that I could focus on my podcast full time.
Nice. I'm so happy you did, because I love your podcast.
Me too. Thank you. It's the funnest thing I've ever done. And it's the most exciting and fulfilling and juicy. And I just love it so much.
It's amazing. And as someone who is young and is working in like the outskirts of the industry or the fringes of the industry, I guess, it's like what I listen to for like inspiration of I can do this even if I don't do it the way everyone tells me to. Because everyone on your podcast has their many different stories of like how they broke into the business, I guess. And there isn't like one clear cut way. And I feel like a lot in college is like, this is what you have to do. And then listening to your podcast, I'm like, no, that's not what I have to do at all.
No, as if there's a path.
Yeah.
As if someone could give you the checklist. If you just do these 8 things, you'll find yourself at the top of the world.
Yeah.
Like there is no path at all. I think that's what's so fun about it. It's like, how in the world did you get where you are? And people have the craziest stories.
Yeah. So I just wanted to start off, you kind of already talked about your background, and I just want to know what about your experiences made you want to start the podcast. Like, what was the bright idea moment?
It was a bunch of things happened kind of all at the same time. There was this article that came out in the New York Times. I think it was Maureen Dowd, but I may have that wrong. And it was female directors in Hollywood speaking out about the lack of opportunity. Because I guess the first report had come out where they said 6% of feature films are directed by women. And the tone of that article was like speaking truth to power. Like these women were talking, they were mad as hell, and they weren't going to take it anymore. And I thought, ooh, that is exciting. Like they were calling it out. I'd never seen anything like it. And then at the same time, there was a bunch of chatter about pay inequity with mm-hmm. actresses. And I was thinking, well, you know, Cry Me a River, you got $15 million, not $20 million. And at the same time, that's totally real. It totally needs to be fixed. It is a real issue. And utterly not relatable to me or anybody I knew. And my like secret dream job was always to have a talk show, like a talk radio show.
Uh-huh.
Is that even what you call it? A talk show on the radio?
Yeah.
Anyway, because I've been listening to talk radio my whole life. I'm mm-hmm. obsessed. I don't know what it's called, but I've been listening forever. And so all these things kind of came together and I thought, what if I just started doing this? And so I asked a couple of friends because I knew a bunch of people and everybody said yes and introduced me to 2 other people. And it just snowballed to the point where now I have more interviews than I know what to do with. And it kind of took on a life of its own.
How many interviews do you do? Do you do it like weekly or does it just depend?
Well, starting this year, I'm trying to get a handle on my life.
Okay.
And right now I've picked 1 week a month.
Okay.
Because I was doing interviews. I was doing 3 or 4 a week, and then I had a 6-month backlog. And then I would do an interview and say, oh, that was so great, and it's going to come out in 8 months. And people would be like, I'm kind of promoting my crowdfunding right now.
Yeah.
So that wasn't working. So now I'm trying to do 1 week a month and kind of do the next month's interview. Someday I may get to do 4 on a Saturday and get on with my life. But that's what I'm doing now.
So what type of interviews are, like, your favorite to do? Or, like, what have been highlights of interviews so far?
Gosh, my favorites are always when it's someone who I genuinely really hit it off with and we get in some really juicy conversation right away. There's a couple different types I love. One is that where we are just in it from the very beginning and spilling our guts and every now and then we cry, you know, and it's just like, oh, that was such a good conversation. Like I'm kind of an extroverted introvert. You know, Facebook tells me now.
I relate to that. That's what I am.
And I'm terrible with small talk. Like, I want to get into it. Like, what happened when you were 12 that made you want to, you know, I want to go straight there. So
let's talk about your parents.
When they're willing to do that, I love it so much. And then also every now and then, you know, when you're talking to like a legit artist, you know, there's a lot of really creative people and really competent and really successful and do lots of beautiful work. But every now and then it's like, ooh, that is an artist. like, I don't know how to define it other than you know it when you see it, when it's like something so special and unique and from their guts, they're doing it. And I think that is really exciting. There were a couple that really stand out. One is Sophia Cruz. She is a young woman who is a documentary filmmaker, and she did this film called Little Stones. And the film is four women who are creating social justice through art around the world. So she profiled four different people. Like, one was a dance teacher in India who's helping to heal survivors of sex trafficking through dance. Another is a graffiti artist who's raising awareness about domestic violence, I think, in South America. And it was four women like that. And this woman, she's not even 30, and is just on this mission and was so confident and so beautiful and so, the phrase, like, the rise of the divine feminine, like, as hippy-dippy as that sounds, that's what I thought of while talking to her. She was so owned her power and her mission and what she was doing in the world, and she was so young, and she was just doing it. It was incredible.
Yeah. I listened to that one. It's really good.
I mean, sometimes I listen to these people, and I'm like, oh, my God, I've wasted my life. It's like, I really should have done something so much more important.
Or like, I should have started 10 years ago.
Right, yeah. Right.
So let's dive in to Me Too. We're gonna do it. So you've been interviewing women while this is all happening, and women who are actively working in Hollywood that don't have necessarily the glamorous jobs that we hear about, like, mm-hmm. not necessarily Scarlett Johansson. So how has interviewing them kind of shaped your perspective on this movement?
Well, it's interesting because I started it about a year and a half before this movement started. And I will tell you this. Every single woman has been sexually harassed. Very few of them want to talk about it on tape. As soon as I would turn it off, everybody would tell me their stories. I wrote a couple articles about it because I heard so many stories. And here's the thing. The women I've talked to, and they've all told me their stories, they just got on with it. Like, it didn't derail anybody's career. It was just one more annoying obstacle you had to get through in order to get where you wanted to get. And there were some patterns, and everybody laughs about it because that's what we do as women. You know, that's how you get through it. You hear, oh, yeah, that guy, come on, he said this. Four women told me about a director who called them the C word on set. Four. Like, it got to be a joke. Like, the last person I said, have you ever been called the C word on set? And she was like, oh, yeah, I work with that guy.
Oh, my gosh.
And it just becomes matter of course. Of course, you're going to work with a guy who calls women the C word, and you're just going to either handle it or avoid it or get on his good side or figure out some way to cope with it, because you know the director, up until very recently, was not going to be fired for that behavior. And so you're going to have to figure out how to get along and get on with it and not have it affect your career. Story after story after story after story. Women being pregnant on set and kind of being punished for it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, if you're pregnant, I better not see you sitting down ever. It's like, really? Like, if I had a broken leg, you'd let me sit down?
Yeah.
So the resilience that women have, because we've been so conditioned to accept that as normal and accept that that's the way the business is, so you better just figure out how to roll with it if you're ever going to get anywhere. That's what women have gone through, and that's what they've done. To me, that's what's so exciting about Me Too, is everybody rose up at the same moment and said, we're done. Like, it's not normal. We're not going to take it anymore. We're going to start calling you out. It's over, fellas. We got to figure out a new way to work.
Time's up. Time is up. Do you think there's like a difference in the way, like, interviewing women pre-Me Too and post-Me Too? Is there like a difference in those interviews, or is it still that women don't really want to talk about it?
Oh, no. Now they say, okay, you want to hear my Me Too?
Yeah.
Here's what it is. Now they just volunteer it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think everyone is so excited by what's happening. I mean, even though the movement itself is so painful and so many people are just having these flashbacks of, oh my God, that did happen to me and I suppressed it and I didn't think about it. And now I'm having all these memories of all this stuff that happened. I think a lot of people are going through that. But there's also, we can talk about it now.
Yeah.
Like, the focus has shifted. It's not something shameful that we have to hide and we have to get over. It's something that some poor behaving person did to us. It's enough already.
Yeah.
It's enough already.
Yeah. So who are your role models or any role models growing up?
Oh, this is such a hard question because you know, I think they just change all the time. I thought about this a lot. You know who I'm just love right now? I'm going to do right now as opposed to my role model my whole life. Caitlin Moran. Do you know her? She's a feminist author in England. And Lindy West. And I put them both in the same category because they are just living out loud their truth. They own their voice. They're super feminist. And they are out there in the world just speaking the truth. And I think it is so beautiful and vibrant and brave. And it is what I aspire to be.
Awesome. Final question. Because you always ask people this on your show.
Oh, so now
I'm going to ask you. How the tables have turned.
Oh, I didn't expect this.
So, do you think you're a success?
Yes. I've learned that that is how you should answer that question. Yes, I am a success. I have accomplished many things in my life, and I'm happy in my life, and I have a beautiful family, and yes.
Wonderful.
And that really is hard.
It's hard, I think. It's hard to be like, am I? Because it's like, who's to say? Who's to measure that?
What does success mean? And I haven't accomplished every goal I ever wanted to do in my life. And I'm a woman, so I'm supposed to be humble. And I'm supposed to say I was lucky and I had a lot of help. You know, all those things, all that conditioning we have to overcome just to say, well, yes, I am successful. Thank you for asking.
And then, are you a badass?
Yes. Yes, I am a badass. Although my current thinking about the word badass is evolving.
Really?
It is.
How so?
Let's go there. When I first started doing this, I started asking everybody, are you a badass? Because I thought about it as we're owning our power. We're going to go out there and do it and accomplish what you want to accomplish and break through your fear. And all that to me was badass. And now I feel like we're collectively kind of moving through this period of rage. And I think when we're on the other side of it, badass to me is going to feel a little harsh. Because I think I want us to be in a more embodied feminine place that owns power in a much more centered way.
Wow.
As I said, that's evolving, and I reserve the right to have a completely different definition tomorrow.
So what do you think, what would the new word be instead of badass?
It's something like empowered, but it's not empowered, because that to me feels like external, someone is giving you power.
Yeah.
It's something about standing in our power.
Owning it yourself.
And just knowing it and not having to fight for it. Because you know it and you own it. It's like in Wonder Woman, in the first 5 minutes.
Yes.
When the women were standing on the island, no men anywhere, owning their power and standing in it. And we all cried and didn't know why we were crying.
Yeah.
Did this happen to you?
Oh, sobbed during that movie.
And nothing had happened yet. And I'm like, what is wrong with me? Like, why am I crying? They're just standing there. And then I read 100 articles of women who had that same experience. And they said, we had never seen before women standing in their power and owning it unapologetically, not in relationship to a man, just owning their own power. And I know I keep saying the same words over and over again, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I agree. All right, Julie. Where can we find you? What do you want to promote? What do you want to plug?
Thanks for asking.
Yeah.
You can find The Other 50%, A History of Hollywood, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbay, iHeartRadio, and the other one, Spotify.
Spotify.
And also my website, theother50percent.com, all spelled out in letters. Go there and subscribe, and then you'll get a little note from me every time I put out a new episode.
And you also have a book.
I do have a book.
Can't forget about your book.
It's funny because I wrote it 10 years ago and I just now put it out. It's called You'll Never Have a Baby in This Job Again. Isn't that a great title?
It's an amazing title.
It's all about navigating pregnancy discrimination in corporate America. Because I had 3 babies while I worked at a corporation. And a lot of my friends were having babies at the same time. And some of us had great experiences and some of us had not so great experiences. And we started asking each other, you know, how was it for you at work? And just in our circle, we heard 4 horrible stories. And so my co-author and I, Sybil Golan, we reached out on the internet and asked people for, how did it go for you having a baby at a corporation? We got 100 stories, all of them bad. And so for the book, we just laid out, here are the actual laws in place for pregnancy discrimination. Here are all the stories the women told us and how they correspond with those laws and how things maybe could have gone differently had these women had the information before they went into this.
Yeah.
So the book is really that. Be armed with all the information before you go in and tell your boss that you're pregnant so that you know what your rights are, what you should ask for, how you should negotiate it, how you should put it on paper so that after your maternity leave, you can come back and still have your career.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and for talking to us.
Thank you for having me. This was super fun.
Thanks.
If you have any other suggestions about people who should be on The Bitch Next Door, you can go to our website. You can find a submission page on there. That's umpboh.com.
You can also join us on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History. Join our discussion group as well. We are always posting tons of articles there, and mm-hmm. we love talking to our listeners.
Absolutely. You can find us on Twitter at Bitchery Podcast.
And Instagram at The Bitchery of History.
As always, we could not do this without our amazing team, that is Jeanette,
Kim,
Sydney,
and Jess.
And as always, bitches get stuff done.